more choppy.
Our political editor, Chris Mason, BBC News.
And the news was read by Vigialis. Comedian Rachel Paris is a Jane Austen fan and geek, and she'll be assessing one of our greatest writers' feminist credentials in our stand-up special next.
Hello, I'm Miles Jupp.
BBC Radio 4's new magazine programme.
I'm doing a campaign for this sort of dairy allergy awareness month. Actually, they're not calling it that.
What are they calling it?
I don't want to say.
Well, this is a non-judgmental space, Miles.
Lactose intolerant April.
Oh, dear.
Well, exactly.
Whatever next with Miles Jupp.
One of the things we radio presenters like to do is enjoy a matey handover with the host of the next on-air programme, dispelling the idea that we're all a bunch of egocentric grifters who would claw each other's eyes out for a spot on Celebrity Antics Road Trip.
The new 6:30 comedy for Wednesday nights on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And it's comedy now on Radio 4 with Ostensibly Feminist. Jane Austen wrote 6 major works and is credited with inventing the modern novel. But does she pass muster as a feminist icon? Self-confessed Austen geek Rachel Paris looks at the work of one of our greatest writers and asks what it tells us about her attitudes to women and the lives they led.
You pierce my soul. I'm half agony, half hope. Tell me not that I am too late, that such precious feelings are gone forever. Dare not say that man forgets sooner than woman, that his love has an earlier death. I have loved none but you. Unjust I may have been, weak and resentful I have been, but never inconstant. For you alone I think and plan. You do believe that there is true attachment and constancy among men. Believe it to be most fervent, most undeviating in F.W.
Someone's new to Tinder. A letter from FW there, which of course stands for four. Hello, I'm Rachel Paris, and welcome to Ostensibly Feminist. My name's Rachel. I'm a comedian, I'm a feminist, and I love the works of Jane Austen. Now, I know what you're thinking. Old-fashioned, dry, polite, boring. And in some ways, I am. But let's focus on Jane. You're probably familiar with her to some degree. You may have reluctantly studied her at A-level, you may have read the complete works, or you may have repeatedly watched Colin Firth emerging damply from a lake on VHS for much of the 90s. But do you think of Jane Austen as a feminist? I do. I think the most common attitude to the Austen novels is that they're at best a witty, light-hearted bit of fun, and at worst, frothy, silly, and of little substance. The pina colada of literature. So if you do like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain, this is for you. But there's more to Austen than flirting girls, fancy balls, and country weddings. Or rather, the flirting, the balls, and the weddings hold a lot more meaning than you think. And within the confines of the world she was living, Austen was able to project a clear feminist point of view. And I want to show you the feminist Austen. And here to help me are Jason and Gemma. Hello, Jason and Gemma. Now, many of you will be wondering, what was that piece of audio erotica that we heard at the start of the show? Well, this isn't sexy book at bedtime. That was an extract from Persuasion, specifically a letter from Captain Wentworth, the 19th century equivalent of Chris Hemsworth, but on a boat. So how can I convince you? What makes Jane Austen feminist, you cry? Well, firstly, stop crying. And secondly, good question. If you asked the average man on the street, he might say,
Jane Austen? Isn't that all bonnets and dancing and la-di-da-di-da?
And that's why we mustn't talk to men on the street. Although, to be fair, there is a bit of la-di-da-di-da. And sure, all the books end with a marriage, often to a rich man. And yes, none of the women have jobs. Elizabeth Bennet never once wears a trouser suit, and none of them seem to know any karate. But I'm undermining my point. To really understand how feminist Jane Austen is, you need to know the context. I feel on rocky ground saying this in a BBC broadcast, but it was a different time. The women in these novels appear to have a life of luxury, but that life hung by a thread, and that thread was marriage. These women couldn't vote, couldn't work, couldn't own property. Therefore, marriage for women had to be a calculated economic decision, or they'd literally have nowhere to live. Put it this way, if you weren't Elizabeth Bennet in the sheets, you were Elizabeth Bennet on the streets. So, a prospective bride today might ask,
is he taller than me? Is he a cat or a dog person? Does he have Apple TV?
Whereas a prospective bride back then would need to ask,
how long is the lease on his estate? And is it entailed down the male line? Can he support my unmarried sisters? Does he have Apple TV?
Very ahead of their time. So the point is, marriage was a big deal. It was hard enough for a woman in those times to secure a future for herself, her family, her children. But Austen's characters wanted more than that. They demand more than society wants to give them, and they get it, but they have to fight for it. Let's take this proposal scene from Pride and Prejudice between Mr. Collins...
single, slimy, bit thick.
...and Elizabeth Bennet.
Strong walker, funny, fine eyes.
Elizabeth is one of five unmarried sisters, and when her dad dies, Mr. Collins will inherit their house. That's right, none of the daughters are random cousin, because he's a man. You know the random cousin that you don't like? Imagine if he tapped you on the shoulder at your dad's funeral and said,
sorry for your loss. I own your Nintendo now. And can you show me where the stopcock is?
Understandably, Elizabeth's mother is desperate for her to get married. Turns out mums haven't changed in 200 years. This is Elizabeth's first credible proposal. If she marries him, everyone's life is solved. There's only one problem. He's a massive creep.
Almost as soon as I entered the house, I singled you out as the companion of my future life.
Almost. You made a play for a sister first.
Being as I am, to inherit this estate after the death of your honoured father, I could not satisfy myself without resolving to choose a wife from among his daughters, that the loss to them might be as little as possible when the melancholy event takes place, which, however, may not be for several years.
Stop talking about her dad dying.
To fortune, I am perfectly indifferent, and I am well aware that £1,000 in the 4%, which will not be yours till after your mother's decease...
Stop talking about her mum dying!
...is all that you may ever be entitled to. On that head, therefore, I shall be uniformly silent, and you may assure yourself that no ungenerous reproach shall ever pass my lips when we are married.
You are too hasty, sir. You forget that I have made no answer. I am very sensible of the honour of your proposals, but it is impossible for me to do otherwise than to decline them.
Yes, girl.
It is usual for young ladies to reject the addresses of the man whom they secretly mean to accept. It is by no means certain that another offer of marriage may ever be made you.
That's always nice to hear, isn't it?
I must therefore conclude that you are not serious in your rejection of me, but wish to increase my love by suspense, according to the usual practice of elegant females.
Do not consider me now as an elegant female, intending to plague you, but as a rational creature, speaking the truth from her heart.
Amazing. I want that on a tea towel. Elizabeth later even turns down Mr. Darcy first time, and he's got £10,000 a year and looks great in breeches. Lizzie is very much the Lizzo of her day. She knows her worth, and it turns out she is 100% that bitch. And it's not just Lizzie. In Mansfield Park, Fanny Price turns down rich Henry Crawford. In Emma, Emma refuses Mr. Elton. Her girls are picky, and rightly so. Oh, and in case you're feeling sorry for Mr. Collins, it's 1812, he's a man, he's fine. He gets accepted days later by Lizzie's best friend, Charlotte. What has Mr. Collins got going for him? He's not good looking, he's not funny or smart. All he's got is he owns his own house. I mean, actually, now I hear myself saying that, I do get that. That is a big draw. Good for Charlotte, actually. Good for Charlotte. I'm a millennial, and in my friendship group, I've literally only known one man who owned a house, and I married him.
What's he like?
Oh, thanks for asking. Three bedrooms, great transport links. So you see, the balls and the big houses and the pretty dresses are what you see from the outside. But when you strip away the petticoats, as it were, what you have is women in difficult circumstances trying to make the best decisions for themselves. Let's shine a light on the men for a change. Austin writes complex, interesting men, and through not rewarding macho idiots and favouring sensitive, enlightened men, she's saying, look, reader, this is what a good guy looks like. Austin's male characters are more nuanced than you might imagine. It's not all top hats and brooding looks. I mean, there's a few of them. You've got to keep the punters happy. Even by today's standards, you can track your own torrid love life by the characters in any given Austin novel. I'm not going to tell you how many boyfriends I've had, but in Jane Austen terms, I'd be a ruined woman. Let's take Sense and Sensibility. At 20 years old, you fall for your Willoughbys. Gorgeous, charming, knows a weird amount of poetry off by heart, has a vehicle, drives fast, you like all the same books, same bands, or same string quartets. He seems besotted, and then one day, he ghosts you. By 30, you've had your heart broken by Wickhams and Willoughbys, and you go for a lovely Edward Ferrars. Sweet, grateful, bit of a pushover. He's basically very nice to you. He's supportive, soft, comforting. He's the romantic equivalent of an orthopaedic cushion. He always lets you decide what films to watch or string quartet to listen to. But by 40, you're ready for your Colonel Brandon. Steadfast, committed, knows who he is, great in an emergency, and he's probably got a signature dish. Do you have a signature dish, Jason?
Shepherd's pie.
Oh, that'll do. Lovely. Do you have a favourite string quartet?
I prefer folk music.
Well, this isn't going to work. Austin doesn't just present a fancy plate of hotties and leave us to it. She judges her men by high standards. Her heroes aren't the ones who sweep you up on their horse in the rain or perform weird solo slam poetry sessions. They're the ones who call your mum when you get sick from going out in the rain and wait at your bedside. While we're at it, stop going out in the rain. It seems very dangerous and you might get one of those near-fatal colds. Did you know that 9 out of 10 women in Austin's day died from rain? What can a girl on the dating scene learn from Jane Austen? Well, it might seem like the stories are all about the end game, but actually these books are about single men and women going out together to parties, dancing, flirting, drinking, getting to know each other, and the dating scene in her books is all too recognisable to anyone who's ever logged onto Bumble, despaired, and then immediately thrown their phone into a Kenwood Magimix. And don't forget that in Austen's world, these connections weren't just about romance. They were about networking, making crucial contacts. A ball was basically Love Island meets LinkedIn. Catching the eye of a rich man at a social occasion could be as life-changing as landing a job interview. Although, the last time I wore a bonnet to an interview, they said, well, to be fair, they said, welcome to Oxford, you'll fit right in. Emma Woodhouse, as the only one of Austin's leads who has financial independence, is free to make all her life decisions based on love. And she does. If you don't know Emma, it's about a teenage girl who loves matchmaking, who lives with her father in a big house in Beverly Hills. She fails her driving test and falls in love with Paul Rudd. It's in many ways the most modern of all of Austin's work. In the book, Emma is portrayed as, what's the academic phrase here, a spoilt twat. And Jane Austen makes her attitude to rich women very clear. You can hear her implicit judgment in every word. It's like most of my WhatsApp groups.
I have none of the usual inducements of women to marry. Were I to fall in love, indeed, it would be a different thing, but without love, I am sure I should be a fool to change such a situation as mine.
Right on. So there's no financial jeopardy for once. Emma's story is unique in Austen's output in being more about character development. The main thing at stake in the story is whether or not she will stop being a twat. And she does. So a happy ending. But the back and forth flirtations between Emma and Frank Churchill in Emma, Lizzie and Wickham in Pride and Prejudice, and Marianne and Willoughby in Sense and Sensibility are as full of game playing, missed messages, and the 19th century equivalent of being left on two blue ticks, but there's no response, and you know they've read it, and it's been 3 days, and you know they've been online, and you keep seeing typing, typing at the top, and they never... Anyway. Let's take this scene from Sense and Sensibility. Marianne and Willoughby have been seriously dating for months. They've gone riding in town, he's friends with her mum, he's even taken a lock of her hair. For context, that's serious. It's not putting a ring on it, but it is akin to moving in, sharing rent and buying a lockdown puppy. Then one day, Willoughby disappears until Marianne and her sister Eleanor spot him across the room at a ball talking to a...
very fashionable-looking young woman.
Tale as old as time. See if you can spot Marianne not exactly playing it cool here.
At that moment, Marianne first perceived him, and her whole countenance glowing with sudden delight. She would have moved towards him instantly, had not her sister caught hold of her.
Good heavens, he is there, he is there. Oh, why does he not look at me? Why cannot I speak to him?
Pray, pray be composed and do not betray what you feel to everybody present. Perhaps he has not observed you yet.
Good God, Willoughby, what is the meaning of this?
Okay, I think he's observed you now.
Have you not received my letters?
You got the WhatsApps, I saw the ticks.
I did myself the honour of calling in Berkeley Street last Tuesday and very much regretted that I was not fortunate enough to find yourselves at home. My card was not lost, I hope.
But have you not received my notes? Here is some mistake, I am sure. Some dreadful mistake. What can be the meaning of it? Tell me, Willoughby, for heaven's sake, tell me, what is the matter?
Smooth.
Yes, I had the pleasure of receiving the information of your arrival in town, which you were so good as to send me.
Marianne, now looking dreadfully white and unable to stand, sunk into her chair, and Eleanor tried to screen her from the observation of others while reviving her with lavender water.
It's not a good night unless you wake up the next day, mascara all down your face and smelling of lavender water. We've all been there. Marianne thinks Willoughby is the one, but he isn't good enough, and she comes to realise that. In all her books, Jane Austen is telling you, the reader, not to bother with these players. She's your best mate, holding you back, shouting, "He's not worth it, Sandra! Leave it!"
But I love him.
You are a princess, girl! You deserve a prince!
I'm going over.
Don't you dare! He's trash! Get in the Uber! Today, when a book, film, or a TV show is written that has a female lead role surrounded by other lead female roles, and the men are treated as just love interests, it's celebrated as radical, forward-thinking, a feminist coup. You don't find many stories like that now. They just remake Emma and Little Women every 4 years like clockwork. Last time I saw a film with more than one female lead, the plot was extremely thin, the acting was wooden, and it really upped my hotel bill. We've got a female Doctor Who now, but imagine if the Doctor had all female assistants, a female villain, and all female alien robot angels. You could fuel the national grid on the renewable energy source of Gammon Fury. But Jane Austen was doing this simple thing back in 1814, and she got it all done before she died at 41 of rain. Now, you might have heard of something called the Bechdel test. It's a sort of feminist measuring stick that assesses whether a work features at least two named women who talk to each other about something other than a man. Easy, right? Apparently not. Only about half of all Oscar-winning films pass this simple test. In the words of Mr. Knightley, badly done. But do Austen's works pass the Bechdel test? Bitch, please. Austen shows us women talking to each other about parents, kids, countryside, music, dancing, the nature of their own characters, the value of discretion versus passion, and crucially, bonnets. Now, modern feminists often refer to the sisterhood, but Jane's richest output was giving us a huge range of actual sister relationships. Sisters who support each other, sisters who betray each other, sisters who are the same, sisters who are wildly different, sisters who steal your new bonnet and stretch it out with their big fat head. In Pride and Prejudice, Lizzie and Jane are incredibly close. Early in the book, Lizzie receives a letter from Jane.
My dearest Lizzie, I find myself very unwell this morning, which I suppose is to be imputed to my getting wet through yesterday.
Rain. It's at this point Mrs. Bennet says,
people do not die of little trifling colds.
They bloody do. It's an absolute death sentence. So then Elizabeth, wanting to visit her sister, risks her own life by going out in, say it with me, rain. The rain. Yes, correct.
Elizabeth, feeling really anxious, was determined to go to her, though the carriage was not to be had. Walking was her only alternative.
The distance is nothing. Only 3 miles. I shall be back by dinner.
Only 3 miles. The last time I walked 3 miles, they gave me a Duke of Edinburgh award.
Elizabeth continued her walk, field after field, jumping over stiles, springing over puddles, and finding herself at last in view of the house, with weary ankles, dirty stockings, and a face glowing with the warmth of exercise.
I.e. sweating like a pig. Now, not all sisters in Austin are as close, or even like each other very much. Take the Elliot sisters in Persuasion. Anne is meek, wise and quiet, whereas Elizabeth is, well, she's an absolute toilet of a person. Persuasion is the story of Anne Elliot, who broke up with the man she loved at 19, and he comes back to town 8 years later and is now a celebrated sea captain. For context, imagine the boyfriend that you dumped when you went to uni comes back 8 years later and is now a celebrated sea captain. I'm just saying, you'd be like, I'm listening. In Persuasion, we also meet the Musgrove sisters. These are teenage girls who are flighty, flirtatious, and both trying to catch the attention of the same man in increasingly embarrassing ways, including dallying on a cob. Just when we say cob, we're talking about a sort of high stone pier, not a cheese and onion roll. So if you're listening in the Midlands, please don't send me letters.
All the ladies were contented to pass quietly and carefully down the steep flight of stairs, excepting Louisa. She must be jumped down them by Captain Wentworth. In all their walks on the cob, he had to jump her from the stiles.
Catch me, I'm so light, I'm so weak, open this jar, we can see what you're doing.
He advised her against it, but no, she smiled and said, I am determined, I will. He put out his hands, but she was too precipitate by half a second. She fell on the pavement on the lower cob and was taken up, lifeless. Her eyes were closed, she breathed not. Her face was like death. Captain Wentworth, who had caught her up, knelt with her in his arms, and Mary, her sister, screamed, she is dead! She is dead!
Look, we've all flounced off the end of a cob trying to impress a guy, but it looks less cool if you go all Humpty Dumpty and crack your bonnets open. Luckily, Louisa survives her head injury, which happens to directly lead to an engagement to another man. And to be fair, I'm sure we've all been to weddings where we've wondered if the bride has a head injury. Jane writes countless examples of women supporting each other. Lizzie and Charlotte, Marianne and Eleanor, Mrs. Bennet and her sister. And Austin saves her shadiest shade for women who don't support other women. Elizabeth Elliot, Mrs. Norris, Fanny Dashwood, Mary Crawford. And as for rich women who drag down poorer women, there's a special place in Austin Hell reserved for them. And by Austin Hell, I don't mean ITV's Sanderton. Caroline Bingley is the rich, snide, snobbish sister of Mr. Bingley, who has the hots for Darcy. She's like that toxic friend who says things like,
you look tired.
Translation, you look terrible.
Oh, you've had a haircut.
You look mad.
You look healthy.
Oh, thank you.
Have you put on weight?
Oh. Lady Catherine de Bourgh is another rich, snobbish woman who looks down on, well, everyone, really. If she existed today, she'd be hilarious on Gogglebox, but a nightmare on Twitter, and she'd definitely troll Meghan Markle. Towards the end of Pride and Prejudice, she visits Elizabeth to threaten her into not marrying Darcy. Austin gives us a really satisfying takedown, and Elizabeth isn't intimidated in this battle of wealth versus wit.
I was told that you, that Miss Elizabeth Bennet would, in all likelihood, be soon afterwards united to my own nephew, Mr. Darcy. Is this to be endured? The upstart pretensions of a young woman without family, connections, or fortune. Are the shades of Pemberley to be thus polluted?
Shades of Pemberley by Farrow and Ball is very tasteful but pricey.
Do not expect to be noticed by his family or friends. Your name will never even be mentioned by any of us. These are heavy misfortunes indeed, but I am only resolved to act in that manner which will, in my own opinion, constitute my happiness, without reference to you or to any person so wholly unconnected with me.
Seriously, where is the merchandise for these quotes? Emma Woodhouse has the potential to fall into the same trap as Lady de Burgh. She's a rich heiress, she enjoys a sense of superiority, but Austin comes down hard on her when she forgets to be kind to other women. On one occasion, she publicly makes fun of the older, poorer Miss Bates and is told off for it by Knightley, which I'm afraid I find quite hot.
Were she prosperous, I could allow much for the occasional prevalence of the ridiculous over the good. Were she your equal in situation, but Emma, consider how far this is from being the case. She is poor. She has sunk from the comforts she was born to, and if she lived to an old age, must probably sink more. Her situation should secure your compassion. It was badly done, Emma. Badly done indeed.
It might not seem feminist, a man telling off a woman, but in this case, it's clear that Knightley is the voice of Austin, saying to her own character, don't be that guy. So what have we learned? Well, rain is fatal, and Jason makes a mean shepherd's pie. And also, if you've got a sister with a fat head, don't let her near your best bonnet. What else? That when Austin is writing about romance, she's also writing about economics. So every marriage refusal, defiant comeback, and muddy dress means 10 times more than it would today. Her heroines are more powerful than many of the powerful women roles written now, and they're not even wearing skin-tight black spandex. What's clear to me is Austin doesn't believe this society is fair, and she wanted better for women. She wanted a world where women had agency, where men were decent, and where there was room for every kind of woman to exist and to make her own choices, even if that choice was, I'll stay single, earn my own money, and enjoy my cats, thank you. The choice she made for herself. Austin was writing to a happier future. In the words of Mrs. Dashwood,
know your own happiness. You want nothing but patience, or give it a more fascinating name. Call it hope.
Austin wrote in hope of better things for women, a hope we still have now, equality, fair dealings, and fewer deaths from rain. But for now, we're all off to enjoy some shepherd's pie on the cob. Goodbye.
That was Ostensibly Feminist, written by Rachel Paris and Katie Story, starring Rachel Paris, Gemma Whelan, and Jason Forbes. The producer was Alison Vernon Smith, and it was a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 4.
And tomorrow's 6:30 comedy is a freewheeling, whimsical sketch show slipping between the real and imagined. Miles Jupp turns his hand to a new BBC One game show, Guess